are a microcosm of the problems of interpreting the whole book. And here, and I think I've tried to list those for you on this background study. Number one, there are two things we do not know and can know which extremely complicate accurate exegesis. Number one, there is a crisis of some kind at Corinth. If it's Roman persecution, local persecution, Jewish persecution, a preaching of the end times coming, get ready, we do not know. But there is a unique pressure at Corinth that Paul speaks to here. He never speaks to again in any other church. We don't know what that pressure is. Number two, Paul is not sitting down talking in an uninfluenced environment of the questions he's answering. He is answering specific questions written to him by the church at Corinth. But we don't know what the questions are he wrote. Now, we assume they're this or that, but we do not know. And what really complicates it, number three, I think he quotes the letter they wrote him several times through here, but the Greek text is not able to record quote marks. So you never know when he's quoting what they said and reacting to it, or he's saying something himself and reacting to it. Which we are really in a bag of worms. Now, I'm going to do the best I can textually. When all said and done, this cannot be answered textually. Okay? I cannot be dogmatic in what the Bible says. I'm going to give you several options on different points. And that is the best I can do. If I think one of them has a preponderance of evidence, I'll give you my opinion. Other than that, I'm not sure I can answer all the questions. This is the problem of cultural Christianity versus universal truth. Now, there are some things Paul's going to say at Corinth that I do not believe are God's universal plan for every age and every geographical location. But that's just my hang-up. I'm not sure that's the text. Okay, you hear what I'm saying? We're going to struggle with what is applicable in every situation in every country and what is applicable only to Corinth in the first century. Second, there are two problem groups in this church, not one, two. When Greek philosophy, with its basic tenet that matter is evil and spirit is good, when that impacted Christianity through Gnosticism or whatever, it caused two diametrically opposite reactions. One is, if matter is not significant, only spirit, then let the body do anything it wants to, it doesn't make any difference. Just indulge the body. If it feels good, do it, be the bumper sticker of one of these Gnostic groups. But the other Gnostic group, the same teaching went the other way. If the spirit is bad, and I mean, if the matter is bad and the spirit's good, then anything the matter wants, don't give it. You know, there was some monks that actually took pig skin and wore it with the brills in, naked in the winter. And you hear what's happening? If it hurts, it's good for you. You know, the more you can have pain, the more you can suffer. That's what makes you spiritual. Now, both those tendencies are in the church right now. Both of them. You know, run off to the hills is the best thing. Do whatever you want to. Now, I think Paul is trying to walk a tightrope between those two extremes. All truth has two ditches. And what we do, we just run right over the ditch into the other one usually. You know, it's like if this is wrong, then we say, it's all wrong. And so we just go from here to here. And what Paul's trying to do is tightrope down that truth to speak to the abusers on both ends of that spectrum. And it's a hard thing. I want to mention to you that I think there is a universal principle that I have found for me. It's in number C under background. I think it's mentioned in verse 8. I think it's explicated fully in 17, 20, 24, 26, and 40. And Paul says, it's bad right now, stay as you are. Wherever you are, whatever you are, stay there. That's what I think that is the universal principle throughout, and he is consistent with that. D, I want to say a word about Mary. This has been the chapter people say, Paul doesn't like women. I don't know if Paul liked women or not, but this passage can't be backed up for that. This is not a disparaging chapter on marriage. This is a disparaging chapter on the culture at Corinth, which was unbelievably pagan, where everything you did had sexual connotations. And so I think it's a reaction to that. I think if you're going to take the Bible as a whole, which you've got to do and you cannot proof text, Sex is good. Marriage is of God. He made us that way. It's His plan. We're just doing what's natural. There are God-given boundaries, yes, but it's good. And you can't let this one chapter destroy what the rest of the Bible teaches. And even Paul in Ephesians 5 puts a glorious picture on sexual union as a earthly example of Christ in the church. So we cannot take this chapter as being terribly disparaging of marriage. I wish I had time to develop this completely, but Paul's going to say circumcision is not important. And I'm going to tell you what Paul's doing. I want you to think of me what Paul the apostle, called of God, is doing. Jesus said, not a jot or a tittle will pass away till it's all fulfilled. Paul says, this is not valid anymore. I mean, flat out. Jesus said, not a dot or a tittle. The Old Testament says, you shall be circumcised to every generation. It is a commandment of God. And Paul says, forget it. Now, what Paul is doing, he's not taking away tradition. He is undercutting the foundation of Judaism. What he's saying is, Old Testament rites and Old Testament rituals have been fulfilled in Christ and passed away. Now, he'll do the same for food laws. Now, some say, well, he keeps the moral and he acts as a ceremonial. If you told a Jew there was a ceremonial and a moral aspect to his law, he'd laugh at you. They don't see any difference between that. And we've got to be very careful not to just, in our real, fine, logical, say, well, he's just doing this and leaving this. He's not. Paul's not consistent with that. He loves the Old Testament. But in Christ, all things have become new, including circumcision and Judaism. Okay, with that, let's get into the text then. We're going to try to do 40 verses. I only got 45 minutes, so if I start talking extremely rapidly, and don't give you a chance to ask questions, you know it's out of fear. Now, in verse 1 it says, now I take up the matters about which I wrote you. This is the chapter that begins Paul's answering of specific questions that the Corinthian church wrote him. And we find this little phrase, chapter 7:1, chapter 7:25, 8:1, 12:1, 16:1, all have this little Greek phrase that say he is responding to a problem that the church wrote him in the letter. Okay? So this was a problem area. It may be a good thing for a man to remain unmarried. Now, you probably have it. It's a good thing for a man not to touch a woman. I think it's King James. Now, that sounds to me like a quote from their letter. Now, what side would say that? This side or this side? Okay, they'd say, yeah, if you make it married, it would probably be this side. But see, both could twist it around and say, yeah, it's not good to have a wife. You'd be free. You hear? The other side would say, don't even think of those things. Don't even do that. Well, I think Paul is saying there's a truth in what you say. But now he is going to limit the truth. He said, you've said something that's partially true. Now let me limit how I think that is true. And I think he's going to limit it. He's going to assert it's true, which surprises us. And this is where folks say, oh, he's against marriage. Paul had a major problem church at Corinth. Things were falling apart in every aspect of that church's life. And Paul wrote them this letter to try to get it back together. And so this is not him saying universal principles. He never said this to any other church. Okay. But because of so much sexual immorality, every man should have a wife of his own and every woman a husband of her own. Now, it seemed like Paul saying, well, if you just can't control yourself, go ahead and marry. Now, that is the mentality that some people get in here. But I think you've got to see the background. Okay? And I think he's reacting to these two extremes who were taking advantage of a main truth and twisting it. Now, when it says every man should have a wife, that is not something that is simply you can if you want to. That is a present imperative. Paul is commanding the continual action of the church to marry. That's the norm. Now, he's going to say, I have a spiritual gift, but the norm is marriage. This is not an option, this is a command. Present imperative. Now, notice where it mentions verse 3 through 5. Now, I've kind of capsuled that for you down there in the verse 3, where it talks about a husband and wife must give each other their due rights, or that their bodies don't belong to themselves, they belong to each other. This reflects the problem at Corinth. Now, we don't know what the problem was exactly. Some people say that there was a thing called spiritual marriages here, which we do know started in Corinth after 200 years. This is way before, that's 150 years earlier than that. We have no record of it. It's called a spiritual marriage, where a man and a woman would marry but have no sexual relations. They'd sleep in the same bed, live in the same house, but it was a way of showing a super control. And apparently the people were saying, well, if you need sex, go out to the whores or go out to the male prostitutes, but just don't do it at home. And Paul seems to be saying, if you're married, your bodies don't belong to you. When you marry, this one flesh ideal goes between two people. And marriage is a mutual thing between two individuals, and they both have reciprocal rights. Now, what's so surprising here is, in Paul's day, women were extremely, extremely considered chattel, property. Could be divorced for any reason. It was unbelievable, the condition of women. And what Paul does, look, and then in verse 4 he says, the wife has her right to it. Now, what Paul does is he brings a balance to an imbalanced society. He does that for wives and husbands in Ephesians chapter 5. He does it for parents and children in Ephesians 6. He does it for slaves and masters. He says something that seems to hit us wrong because of our day. In his day, this is a radically positive statement. What he was telling that husband is, you aren't the only master in sexual issues in your home. Your wife is an equal partner in the decisions sexually you make. Now, that was a radically positive statement in its day. That's trying to bring some form of rights and obligations and privileges to a lady in a marriage. And so I think we miss that because we're so used to our day. But that is a radically positive statement. Now, verse 5. You husbands and wives must stop refusing each other. Now, do you catch the asceticism here? They would say, the longer you don't make love, the more holy you are. Or sex is a necessary evil, or something like that. Paul's saying, no, 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 no. It is not. It is good. It is wholesome. If you can remain single, remain single. That's better. Don't have all the problems around that. But if you can't, there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing bad. Now, stop refusing each other what is due, unless you agree to do so just for a little while, and so as to have plenty of time for prayer. Now, you may have fasting in your text. It's just not in the Greek manuscripts, the better ones. It shouldn't be there. You mean that time in the life of a couple where they could say together, let's abstain sexually, to commit ourselves to prayer. Now, I won't tell you the truth. I've never done that. But I think if I had a major issue that I had to settle, I know I'd go somewhere and fast. I know I'd do that. Now, whether I took Peggy with me would probably depend on how radically involved she was in that decision specifically. But I think that's a good word. That's saying that there is a unique opportunity among husband and wife to beseech the throne of God. Have you ever thought about that? Setting aside a time where you're going to say, God, we won't give this time to you in priority to prayer. I think it's something to think about. And notice where it says, here's the purpose of this. Don't stay part too long so as to keep Satan from tempting, present tense, you because of your lack of self-control. Is it possible in a married relationship for sexual tensions to come in? Man, you know that's true. Satan can tear up a marriage faster than anything in the world. You know that's true. And so what this says is that just because you're married doesn't mean you're not going to have sexual problems. I used to think when I was a young kid, if I just got married, it wouldn't have any more problems. Golly, what a joke. I'd just exchange problems, you know. So the evil one can disrupt your prayer life, your spiritual life, by what? Attacking that sexual relationship. Be careful about that. That is a thing from God. That is not a thing from the world. That is a good thing and a wonderful thing. Now, I think Satan, a personal force of evil, Paul mentions him up front. And I believe there's a personal force of evil. Verse 6, but I say this by way of concession, not by way of command. Yes, Paul, what are you telling me by way of concession, not by way of command? Does that refer to verses 1 through 5, 3 through 5, the last part of 5? Is Paul saying you don't have to come apart for prayer? Or is Paul saying give each other what's due? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think the last part of 5 fits better, but 3 through 5 could fit just as well. You know, don't deny each other. So I don't know what Paul's saying, but he's saying, I say this to you by way of concession, not by way of command. So it seems like he's talking about the prayer aspect, which can't be legislated. It must be voluntary. Verse 7. However, I should like for everyone to be just as I myself am. What is he? Now, this may surprise you. I think Paul was married. I think I can prove it. Culturally, an unmarried Jew was a real enigma. They would get married just to fulfill Genesis 2:18, be fruitful and multiply. I mean, just to do that. For no other reason, a Jew, especially a rabbi, a Pharisee, would get married just to get everybody off his case. Just to fulfill what they said is a requirement of God. Second, in Acts 26:10, you might want to look at it. It looks funny when you look at it. It says, I cast my vote against them. Well, that seems to be Jerusalem and the Sanhedrin setting. You could not be a member of the Sanhedrin and not be married. Impossible. So I think what probably happened, one of two things. I think Paul's wife died and he's a widower. Or I think Paul's wife left him when he converted. I don't think he's saying don't ever marry. Because I think he was single, but I think he was married once. So he's either saying, be as I am now single, or be as I am, what? Self-controlled. Now, I'm not sure exactly what he's saying. But through this whole passage, Paul's going to say that celibacy is a wonderful gift if you can handle it for the cause of Christ. Now, he's going to say that. There's no doubt he'll say you can do more for the Lord if you're not married. Now, you may not like that, but that's what he's going to say. I think just the opposite is true of my life because I can't handle that area without Peggy. Peggy brings tremendous stability and strength to my life that I would not have if I wasn't married. I'd be worried about sex all the time if I wasn't married. So, sorry, tape. So for me, I need that. That controls, that stabilizes. That truth hurts. Yet each of us has his own special gift from God for one way, another for another. Now what he's saying is this special gift is related to the deal of celibacy or self-control. Now, this special gift is mentioned in verse 17 again and is explicated wonderfully in chapter 12, 1 and following. And I'm going to wait till I get there to talk about that every Christian has a gift. And maybe celibacy is one of those gifts. Now, the word gift is very important. It's called, when I say it, you'll know it. Charismata. Charisma. Hear those words? Charismatic. Now, what's the word for grace? Charis. The word gift is related etymologically to the word grace. It is a given thing freely, not earned, deserved, merited. It's a free gift. And that's very important when we see this. Now, to married people and to widows, I would say this. It would be a fine thing for them to remain single as I am. But if, first class, assume true, since they do not practice self-control, middle voice, they themselves cannot control that sexual passion, let them marry. Now, friends, that is an aorist imperative. That is a once and for all command. That's not an option. Now, that's not saying, I think God has made us to want someone else. That's not bad. That's good. And Paul just saying, if you don't have the gift, friends, don't struggle with it. Marry. There's nothing wrong with marrying. I think some of us are saying marrying's not a good state. And I think Paul's reacting to that. And the abuse on the other side is equally here. Then he says, it's far better to marry than to burn. Now that's what got everybody. They say, oh, croak, Paul. It is far better to marry, aorist tense, than to be burning in the fire of passion. Now, personally, I enjoy flaming in that area. I don't know about you. It doesn't bother me a little bit that I burn with passion. You know, that ain't bad to me. It's only if you interpret this thing bad. Right? We're talking about a gift here, not about merit. If there's a gift, you won't be bothered in this area. Great, use that gift. Don't get married. There's a lot of earthly entanglements come with marriage. A lot of time commitment. A lot of involvement with marriage. A lot of hours in a week. If you ain't bothered in this area, use it for the Lord. If you are bothered, get married. Man, get married. And the implication is the most will marry. Okay? Now, let's continue then, verse 10. To the people already married, I give this instruction. No, not I, but the Lord. Now, I want to mention this because a little bit later on, down in, he's going to say, not I say this to you, though the Lord himself has said nothing about it, in verse 12. And over here a little later, he's going to say, I have no command from the Lord, but I will give you my opinion, verse 25. And then he said, well, that's asserting Paul saying he's not inspired. Oh, quite the opposite. We'll get to that in just a second. What Paul is saying is, when I can, I'm going to quote the words of Jesus. When I can't, I'll give you my Holy Spirit-led opinion. So he's going to quote Jesus' words about what he's going to say. And he has some statements from the Lord. That a wife is not to leave her husband. Matthew 5:32, Matthew 19:6, Mark 10:11-12, Luke 16:18. Jesus put it so well. It's God's will for one man, one woman for life. Now friends, even though we're inundated with divorce on every hand, and though we love divorced people, the truth of the matter is we must hold up the ideal of the New Testament as one man, one woman in Christ for life, period. And not there just beating each other to death, but in great joy and fulfillment and spirituality. That's what it's saying is. And Jesus said that. Divorce is always a reclamation project. Now, I love to preach on the grace of God. I thank God that's a start again. I think He forgives and forgets. I think He still uses us. But the truth of the matter is, the ideal is one man, one woman for life. Would you buy that? And we've got to hold up the ideal as well as grace and love. Verse 11, but if, third class, potential action, she does leave him, she must remain single. Oh, ho, ho. And or be reconciled to her husband. Aorist, passive, imperative. Now that means that she's going to be reconciled by an outside force, either her husband or an arbitrator or somebody. But anyway, once and for all, be reconciled. I instruct the husband, too, not to divorce his wife. Now there are some exceptions, aren't there? Matthew 5:32 is the exception clause of unfaithfulness. And then in 1 Corinthians 7:12-13, we're going to talk about unbelieving partner in the marriage. There are some exceptions to this rule. This is not a hard and fast concrete thing. There have been times people call me and say, I've been beat up. My husband's got a gun. He's threatened to kill me and the kids. What should I do? Get out of the house, woman! Golly, dog, what are you calling me for? You know, there are some occasions. But what we've done is we've lowered the standard so low that it's like if the shoe doesn't fit, I'll get another shoe in our day. It's just gone to where it's just become such a common occurrence that we've lost the sharpness of the New Testament command. Now, to the rest of the people, I myself say this, although the Lord Himself has said nothing about it. Now, this is not a disclaimer. If you look at verses 25 and 40, you'll see Paul saying, I'll give you my opinion as one who is trustworthy, who's had mercy shown me. And then in verse 40 he says, it is my opinion she'll be happier if she remains as she is, and I think I have God's Spirit. Paul is not saying this is not inspired. I don't think Paul ever realized we'd do this to one of his books someday, you know, a different culture. But what he is saying, I am Spirit-led, and I'll give you my opinion, and I think it's valid because I'm an apostle of Jesus Christ called by God. And if he can quote Jesus, he will. But when he can't, he's going to act on that local situation. If a Christian has a wife and he's not a believer and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband and is not a believer but she consents to live with her, he must not divorce that husband. Now, this is not unbelievers marrying believers. This is two unbelievers, one of them gets converted. This deal about, oh, I'll marry that person and I'll convert him. No, you won't. You might, but you're not, it's not guaranteed. I don't think it's ever in the will of God for a mature Christian to marry anything but a mature Christian. There's going to be problems, my soul. Mature Christians ought to marry mature Christians. Now, in verse 14, it comes to say, but the unbelieving husband is consecrated by union with his wife, and the unbelieving wife by union with her Christian husband. For otherwise, your children be unblessed, but in this way they are consecrated. Holy cow, what does that mean? This has been used as a proof text for two unfortunate interpretation. Number one, that if you're married to an active Christian, you're saved too. If you're married to an active believer, the salvation of that believer applies to an unbelieving spouse. It has also been interpreted as a proof text for infant baptism. Now, I'll say this to you. I'm sure I'm biased in some areas, and this is probably one of them, so I'm not sure that I'm speaking without my cultural denominational glasses on, but I will say this. If we're going to apply it to the kids, we've got to apply it to the unbelieving husband, because the exact same relationship exists between the unbelieving spouse and the unbelieving children. So if you're going to get the children holy because there's a Christian in the home, you've got to have the unbelieving spouse holy. And that doesn't fit anywhere in the New Testament that an unbeliever can be saved without a volitional commitment on his part. You see what I'm saying? It's a two-edged sword right in the text. It's got to go both directions. We can't bend it one way for our theological beliefs. It's got to go both. I don't think it goes either. I think this is what's happening. There's been so many interpretations. I've listed some of them for you. Makes the children legitimate, makes them ceremonial clean. I think what it means, just RJ's free opinion to those who give the cooperative program. What we have here is that one believer in the home is a tremendous influence on the unbelieving spouse and the kids. The cultural benefits of being around a believer are going to permeate those kids, permeate that home. Now, I think that's what it means. When I get a hold of Paul, I'm going to say, you little fat bald man, why don't you write a little more clear? But if the unbelieving consort actually leaves, middle voice verb, they leave themselves, let them separate, in such cases the Christian wife or husband, here's another real hanger, boy, is not bound. Now, mine has is not morally bound. It's a perfect passive verb. I've seen that used as a proof text for Christian remarriage. If you were to ask me point blank, does the Bible teach remarriage? I'd say, New Testament, I'd say no. But if you call me and say, hey, I'm a believer, I've had a divorce, I've got a problem, I found a Christian someone I want to marry, I want to have a Christian home, will you marry me? Oh, yes. Do you hear the ambiguity there? I do not have a New Testament proof text. I just have the general view of the grace of God which I go on. Now, I have told the Lord that I'd rather err in the sight of people than err in the sight of rules. And when I stand before Him, I'll take whatever it takes in penalty for knowingly going against what I believe is a New Testament command. That's something I don't do lightly. I don't believe it's a New Testament opening. It seems to me not bound means that the believing spouse does not have to continue to prayerfully work on the relationship. They are allowed to remain single. I wish I could take questions. I can't. I'll talk to you after this thing. God has called us to live in peace. Now look at verse 16. This has been interpreted exactly opposite ways because we do not hear the person speaking. We do not hear the inflection of the voice. We do not have the proper punctuation to know exactly. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Now, if I quoted 1 Peter 3, 1 through 12 as a proof text for this, it'd be, stay married to unbelievers. You may win them wives by your quiet, gentle spirit. But the context goes against that. The context is, if you're married to unbelievers, just giving you a terrible hassle about you becoming a Christian, and they want to leave, let them. Because you're not sure you can ever win them or not. Now, I don't know which it is. It's either saying, hang in there, you may win them, or it's saying, don't use marriage as a tool for evangelism because you're not sure you'll ever win them. The context seems to favor number two. The parallel passage in Peter seems to favor number one. New paragraph, verse 17. This is, so only everybody must continue to walk or live in the station which the Lord assigned him. This is the universal principle to which I believe marriage, slavery, circumcision are illustrations. What's Paul saying? The times are bad. Things are falling apart around us, church. Don't go entering into new areas of uncertainty. If you're single, stay single. If you're married, stay married. If you've got an unbelieving partner and they want to leave, let them leave. It seems he's saying just cool it for a while. Let's don't enter anything new till we say what's going to happen. I think that's what he's saying throughout here. Now, in that to which God called him, these are my orders in all the churches. Now, that's what blows my theory, doesn't it? You thought I had the interpretation down 100%. If there's a local crisis Paul is reacting to, why did he stick in all the churches in? I can't answer that. I don't know. Verse 18, has a man been called after he was circumcised? He must not try to change it. How do you change circumcision? Did you know it was done? There was a surgical operation to make you look like you were circumcised, and the Jewish boys were doing it. 1 Maccabees 1:15. Now, that's commitment to Greek culture, I think. But has a man been called without being circumcised? He must not be circumcised. Being circumcised or not being circumcised has no value, but keeping God's command is important. Let me give you a few passages on Paul about circumcision not having a spiritual dimension. Romans 2, 28 and 29, Galatians 5, 6, Galatians 6, 15. You know, the Jews said that Abraham stood at the gates of Gehenna, and any Israelite that was circumcised, he would not allow to enter. There's some strong passages in the Old Testament. Moses almost got killed one time because he didn't circumcise one of his kids. It was no minor thing with the Jews. But Paul says, the new age of the Messiah has changed all the rules now. Well, that's a strong, wish I had time to go into that as far as how, what's applicable and what's not in the Old Testament, but I really don't. Let me just say to you that keeping God's commands, that sounds like a prophetic utterance, doesn't it? It's not sacrifice, it's what? Obedience. And I think that's true all the way through. We need to be faithful to the light we have. I think God's not going to be upset at if some person really believes something to be true and prayed about it and did the wrong thing. Boy, I think God's going to be with them. It's when we violate what we know to be the truth that we really get in problems. Obedience, attitude, motive is much more important than Jew or Greek. Male or fee, free. Male or female, slave or free. Now, look at that verse 20 again. Everybody must remain. It's a present imperative in the station which he is called. There's that universal principle. Were you called a slave? Stop letting that bother you. And most of the world was slaves then. Yet, if you can win your freedom, take advantage of such an opportunity. How many of you have a translation, something like that? If you can win your freedom, take advantage of it. How many of you have that? Any of you have something different? Any of you say, don't change your station? Well, the Greek text is ambiguous. And let me just show you what I think is happening. The last little phrase, take advantage of such an opportunity, literally in Greek is two words. Use rather, or rather use. The it's not even there. Rather use it. Use what? Use the opportunity or use being a slave? Can they give you what I think is happening? According to the larger context of chapter 7, would you say Paul says change or don't change? Don't change. Paul would say you're in slavery. You got a chance to get out. For Christ, stay where you are and affect where you live. But now that bothers us, doesn't it? So the other alternative is, he's allowed the believer in a marriage relationship with an unbeliever. He's allowed them to leave, hadn't he? There is a change possible, so it's not totally out of context that he could say, if a believer can leave a relationship, if the unbeliever doesn't want the relationship, maybe it's possible. The correct interpretation is, if a slave gets a chance, he has the opportunity to take it. Now, I don't know. Chapter 7, stay where you are. That's the universal principle all the way through here. But maybe Paul's making the exception here like he made it in believer and unbeliever. I do not know. I hope. I don't know. I'm not going to say I hope even. For the slave who has been called in union with the Lord is the Lord's freedman. In the same way, the freedman who's been called is a slave of Christ. You have been bought and actually paid for. Stop becoming slaves of men. It sounds like he's saying stay where you are. Now, when it says you've been bought with a price, I want to see chapter 6, verse 20. This is a reference to Christ's sacrificial death. It goes back to the Old Testament, Goel, the kinsman redeemer. Stop becoming slaves of men, present middle imperative. What he's saying is, you may work for a man. That man don't own you. Jesus owns you. That's a good thought. You may have to work for folks who are ugly, vicious, hateful. And I want to tell you, you don't belong to those folks. You belong to the Lord. And you act in that situation, so Ephesians 6. You do not react to the hate coming. You always react to the situation because of who you are, not because of who they are, whoever they may be. Circumstances, employers, masters. We act who we are because we are the Lord's. Our responsibility is always the one to act in love. We are not to react. We're to act in love. Then he says that principle again. Brother, each one of you must continue close to God in the very station which he was called. Now that seems to hit again. Don't change stations. But, verse 25, about unmarried women. Now there's another question they ask. I have no command from the Lord, but I'll give you my opinion as one who is trustworthy. See chapter 4, verse 2. Since I have had mercy shown to me, perfect passive participle, by the Lord. Now it is my opinion, in the light of the present crisis, bang! What is the present crisis? I do not know. Is it the horror of pagan immorality all around them? Maybe. It is the persecution at Corinth that hit the early church. I do not know. It's the false teachers that are teaching asceticism on one hand or moral illusion on the other. I do not know. There is something happening at Corinth that it is a good thing for a man to remain as he is. It's a play on verse 1 of chapter 7. Are you married? Perfect. Married? Stay that way. Are you unmarried? Stay that way. Stop trying to get a divorce. Present imperative with the may article twice. Stop looking for a wife. Stop an act already in process. They were trying to get divorced. They were trying to find a new wife. They were Christians. He's saying, this is ridiculous. Stop that. But if, verse 28, third class, potential action, you do get married, you have not sinned in so doing. If a girl gets married, she has not sinned in so doing. But those who do will have trouble in this earthly life. And I am trying to spare you this. Friends, I don't know. I think I'm strong enough to stand up in a persecution. I want to believe myself I am. But you get a hold of my little ones, I'm not sure what I would do to get the little ones out of that. I want to think I'm strong enough to stand up what I believe, irregardless. But my little five-year-old or my wife, you know, it's just hard. With pressures and persecutions, being unmarried was a better state to be in. Now, if that's a universal principle, Christianity would have died out. Right? You know, you can't hang on that long unless you're a real evangelist. So we have accounts of whole families dying in the Roman arena. It records that Nero almost went crazy because they died singing hymns with smiles on their face. The animals killed whole families. I'd rather die alone than die with my family, honest. I mean this. The time's been cut short. Perfect passive. What does that mean? The opportunity for service. That's what John Calvin said it was. The shortness of human life. The opportunity for Christian service. The second coming. We don't know. I think it's the same thing as got to work while there's still light for the night coming, but no man can work. But what that means exactly in Corinth, I don't know. For future, men who have wives should live as if they have none. Those who mourn as if they don't mourn. Those who are glad as though they weren't glad. Those who buy as though they did not own a thing. Those who are enjoying the world as though they were not entirely absorbed in it. For the outward order of this world is passing away. Now what it says is, and I've tried to capsule that in verse 29 for you, because I think this is important. What we're trying to say here is, don't destroy the normal relationships of life. But at the same time, don't destroy them and disrupt them. Don't make them priority. You know, don't let the weeping and the gladness and the marrying and the burying, don't be consumed in the mundane to lose the priority of the spiritual moment and the mandate from God to take opportunity. The normal earthly affairs are not evil. They're good. But they are not ultimate. They are temporal, not eternal. Put your heart on the eternal. Put your energy to the internal. Now, whatever the time is short, I don't know. Is it short here in Lubbock? I don't know. But I know this, if you prioritize the temporal and the mundane, you're going to lose the spiritual blessing. So it's not saying don't divorce your wife and be a hermit. It's not saying quit having sex. It's not saying don't have any kids. It's not saying, you know, get off in your room and pray the whole time. It's saying keep those worldly, normal activities going. Remember, there's a higher priority, a higher calling, a higher purpose. I'm going out of time and tape, so let's see. Where in the world? An unmarried man is concerned with the affairs of the Lord. A married man is concerned with the affairs of the world and how he can please his wife. If you're married, you know that's true. And vice versa. I've never thought as a young preacher, when I married somebody, I put my whole ministry in their hands. Think about it. I trust them enough to let me go, to not leave me, because that's tough with Baptist preachers. And when I make a spiritual decision, I need to bring her into it in prayer and consultation. It's a big decision. It is for your welfare that I am saying this, not to restrain you, it means put an animal halter on you, but to foster good and to help you to an undivided devotion to the Lord. Now, here's one more kicker, bad kicker. If, first class conditional, a father thinks he is not doing the proper thing regarding his single daughter. Now, do you have some translation like that? Father and daughter, father and virgin daughter, father and unmarried daughter. Do you have something like that in yours? Because this is going to be a real textual problem. If you'll turn your outline to verse 36, you'll see the different theories there. There are three major theories. All of them can fit the Greek text. Number one, this refers to a father and his unmarried virgin daughter. That's the most common through the years. Number two, this refers to a man and his fiancée. That may surprise you, but it's in here. I'll show it to you. Or third, it may refer to spiritual marriage. I talked about earlier in the program, being married with somebody but not living sexually together. Okay. And there are some good translations that back that up. You see RSV on number 2. You see New English Bible on number 3. So it's not something way far out. That's a scholarly group put those things together, believes that's true. I believe number 2. And I'm trying to show you why. First of all, can you imagine someone come to their teenage daughter today that's getting ready to get married and say, "Hun, I've prayed about it, and I think you ought to remain a virgin all your life." Runaways, man. The open rebellion. Arsenic in the coffee. Is it all over for us? Is that what this is saying? That's my first question. Now, a father, man, thinks he is doing the proper thing regarding his, and literally the word there is his virgin. Now, that is a terribly unusual word for daughter. There is a word for daughter. Daughter is called virgin in some extraneous Greek documents during this time, but do you normally go around calling your daughter your virgin? You know, I barely speak to her half the time, much less call her that, something like that. If she is past the bloom of her youth. Now, wait a minute. What does that mean? Well, look at this over here on the back page. The bloom of her youth is a little bit, this refers to the normal time of marriage, or since it is possibly masculine as well as feminine, it may be the blossom of the man's passion to get married, not the bloom of the woman's. It is masculine or feminine form. It can be either one. No way to be dogmatic on that. Look at the next one. She ought to do so. Let him do what he desires. He commits no sin. She ought to do, there's the Greek, so ought to be that one wishes. The pronouns are so ambiguous through here, certainty is impossible. But it seems to be saying here, this refers to the man or the woman. The pronouns are ambiguous. Look at the next one. Let them do what she desires. That, again, can just as well be the man as the woman. It's a present imperative. Let them marry. Now, it's the plural. Let them marry. Down in the last part of verse 36. Let's see if I can find it. He commits no sin. Let the daughter and her suitor marry. It's present imperative, but literally it means let them marry. Now, what is the normal interpretation if you have a man, not a father, a man and his virgin, and then it says let them marry? What would you think it's referring to? I think it's a young couple, Christian both, who are planning to get married. Read Paul's letter. Ha! Paul says, don't marry. Now they're in a quandary. They both love the Lord. They want to do what's right. They had planned on getting married at a certain time, and now they don't know what to do. Do I go ahead and do it, or do I not? And Paul says, if you feel those natural flames, marry. It's all right. If you don't feel those natural flames and you can live single, I'm telling you, you'll be better off in this particular crisis. Don't marry right now. Now, I think that's what it is. I think that's what it is. Look at verse 37. That's where he says, if the father, it's the man who stands firm in his purpose without having any necessity for doing so, and he has made the decision in his own heart to keep her single, will do what is right. And so the man who gives his daughter. See how this translation is so interpretive? It's just the man and the virgin all the way through here, or them, whatever. The man who does not do so does even better. Now, what Paul's not saying that celibacy is spiritually better than marriage. He's just saying it's practically better considering the times we live in. That's what he's saying. Last little part. A wife is bound, perfect tense, to her husband as long as she lives. Apparently, they ask him about, well, can you ever remarry? Yeah, right here. If her husband dies, she's free to marry anyone she pleases. Now, this is showing that remarriage isn't a problem. There's not some sin in remarriage. No. This dude's died. You see. Now, then it says, except that he must be a Christian. Well, that's very interpretive. What it means here is, it's either the idea that Christian must marry Christians, and you'll see 2 Corinthians 6:14, or the Greek text could mean she must act as a Christian when she marries, which implies the same thing, but doesn't definitely state it. But it is my opinion she'll be happier if she remains single as she is. The widow's role, which I think were the deaconesses in Timothy, were women over 60 who didn't remarry. Paul tells those young widows, don't you be a deaconess. Remarry. I think he knew what happened. The problems that would happen